I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education, and I'm happy to welcome you to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. I'll go ahead and ask now if you have a cell phone to please turn that off. Appreciate it. I'm going to take this opportunity to remind you that on Sunday we're doing the Sundays with the Modern tours at 1 p.m. on those Sundays. They are with artists, architects, historians, scholars of various stripes that go through either the collection, focus on aspects of the architecture, or deal specifically with the special exhibition. In this case, it's Todd Kurtzer. Who is a historian teaching at TCU, and he's going to offer his very unique perspective on the work of Ed Ruscha in Ed Ruscha Road Tested. So I invite you to come back on Sunday for that. Next Tuesday, the artist Simon Lee is here with his frequent collaborator, the accomplished musician Algis Keys, for a screening of their recently produced Where is the Black Beast? This is a really spellbinding episodic film based on Crow, the life and songs of the Crow by poet Ted Hughes, as well as some of Simon's other works that he'll share with us. And then there's going to be, because of the screening, that will take the hour, and then there will be 30 minutes of Q&A. So I invite you to mark your calendars, call a friend to come with you, come back next week for Simon Lee and Algis Keys as they talk about the piece, Where is the Black Beast, and then the Q&A for 30 minutes after. So it will run until 8:30 next week. So everybody make sure to make note of that. Tonight we have writer, professor, and former cultural counselor for the French Embassy, Annie Cohen-Saul, here to present Leo and His Circle, The Life of Leo Castelli. The American version of this, having been published in May of 2010, and recently released in Italian with publications in Dutch, Portuguese, and Spanish forthcoming. Originally published in French, it received the Art Curiel Prize for Best Contemporary Art Book. So we're really glad to have Annie here tonight to share her experiences in writing the books and her very personal experiences with the subject of the book, Leo Castelli. Born in Algeria, Annie now lives and works in New York, Paris, and Italy, teaching at the National Center for Scientific Research in Paris and working as a research fellow at the Tisch School of Arts at NYU. With a PhD from the University of Paris, Annie is versed in no less than 8 languages and has taught or delivered lectures in possibly every major university across the globe on a very wide array of subjects. She is lauded for her extensive research and her thoughtful presentation with her biography on the French existentialist Jean-Paul Sartre, A Life being an international bestseller, and Painting American winning the 2001 Academy of Beaux-Arts Bernier Prize. Of her most recent book, and of course the topic of this Tuesday evening lecture, the famed art dealer Larry Gagosian has commented, Leo Castelli was my friend, partner, and unwitting mentor. And yet this biography comes as a startling revelation. With great skill and understanding, Annie Cohen-Saul has brought to life a singular personality, uniquely charming, erudite, and savvy, and shown us precisely how he created the business model that the art world follows to this day. Leo Castelli and His Circle is a testament to a great professional legacy and an unlikely life story as compelling as a fine novel, of which I know we are all very anxious to hear more. So please join me in welcoming Annie Cohen-Saul.
Can you hear me? Yeah, it's okay.
Thank you very, very much. And thank you above all for making me discover this extraordinary museum. I think you're really lucky to have this piece of architecture, which is a work of art, where, you know, water mingles with light. And it seemed to me, as I told you, Terry, earlier, that the museum is made for the works of art. It's basically, I think that Donald Judd is enhanced by the museum. Carl André is enhanced by the museum. So it's a treat for me to come over here. I was in Europe until Sunday. And, you know, every time I come to Texas, it's, you know, light and you breathe better. It's true. I mean, the works of art get more oxygen. So thank you so much. And there's so much, so many artists of Castelli, you know, and this Ed Rouché show is already something which is a tribute to Leo. So here we are. The first thing I want to tell you is that I am not an art historian, if you forgive me. I am a cultural historian and a sociologist. Therefore, I will not describe paintings to you tonight. I would not describe the art, but I will tell you about the context in which the art was produced. I'm also a sociologist, and I'm going to tell you about the artist, but I will tell you about the other people around the artist. An artist cannot survive alone. An artist needs a gallerist, collectors, curators, museum directors, and, you know, and the public. And without them, he cannot exist. So that's what I call, as a sociologist, the dynamic actors of the art world, the people who, around the artists, put together the condition of productions for him. And Leo Castelli was the best of all these galleries. I met him when I came to this country in 1989 to represent French culture, as Terry told you. I had written this book on Sartre. I knew nothing about the United States, let alone about New York, nothing. And I was attending a dinner party that somebody threw for me 2 weeks after I arrived to say, you know, poor girl, she knows nobody in town. So she threw a party for me. It was like six people at dinner. And I arrived. And, you know, I was shy, embarrassed. And here was Leo Castelli, who looked at me from head to toe. And he said, oh, dressed as you are, you're going to take New York City by storm. I said, okay, thank you. And he said, you don't look like your predecessors. They were gray men in gray suit with gray ideas. And he said, dressed like that with a transparent skirt and long gloves, I'm telling you good. So I said, thank you. So that's what. And he said, but tomorrow I have a show. It's Roy. I mean, I had to assume it was Liechtenstein. You come to the show. It's an opening, but you stay for the dinner, and then I will teach you American art. So that was the best possible introduction. This man was fantastic. He was brilliant. He was generous. He was erudite. He was elegant. And honestly, he gave me more than anybody else in my life. I arrived in this country knowing about French intellectuals and, you know, and existentialism. Since I met Leo Castelli, I completely dropped French intellectual and existentialism to switch to the art world, and I'm very happy with that. So for 20 years, I've been dealing with the art world in America, and that's thanks to Leo Castelli. So Leo, we're going to start. this is the cover of the book, which is actually an allegory of my... I think I don't want too much dark. I would like more light, please, if you don't mind, because I want to see the people. I want to see you. So, and we should interact. So this cover came from a very interesting story. I was interviewing someone in the city of Trieste, where Leo was born. He was born in Trieste, Italy. And the gallerist told me that one day she gave a show for Leo of his portraits. This is one of the portraits that she showed, and it's a beautiful portrait by Robert Mapplethorpe. And the gallerist had printed this photo on a screen in the gallery, which was, I mean, as big as this wall, and as a, it was a curtain, and it was cut in two. And for the opening, Leo arrived and came through the photo. And I thought that it was so cute that he was appearing, you know, here. So this, the Mapplethorpe portrait, plays the role of Leo's image, Leo's myth. And here, this is the real Leo. So my question was, who is the real Leo, you know, coming out from out of this image? Why? Because Leo Castelli is somebody who spoke a lot. He was extremely a great orator, and he loved talking, and he loved talking about himself. He spoke about himself more than he spoke about his artists. And he told stories, I mean, anecdotes, but you know, those kind of superficial anecdotes that were okay for a while, but after a while it was totally boring. Because he was repeating himself. And, you know, he was interviewed by many magazines and always talking. And always. And somewhere I felt that he was talking and talking and talking in order to hide something. You know, when these people talk and repeat the same stories, it means that they don't want to tell the truth. So they create a myth. They create a veil. They create an image. And that exasperates me. So I decided that I wanted to see exactly, I wanted to see the real person. I wanted to look at, to discover the real Leo Castelli behind this image he had created about himself. As I told you, I was a specialist of, you know, great intellectuals. I wrote about Sartre, about Lévi-Strauss, about Albert Camus. And most of my friends in France told me, but how come are you embarking on such a long research on this man who just was only a dealer? You know, I mean, the writers have written tons of pages and they are, why do you write about this man? You know, at first I didn't know what to answer. I knew that I would work 4 to 5 years on Castelli. But I was convinced that this man was worth 5 years of my life, really convinced. I was convinced that he was much more than these stupid anecdotes he was telling over and over again. I was convinced that behind this myth was a very complicated story. I'm going to tell you what I found. Here is what the sociologist tells about the work of art. The work of art is basically, you can read it. So it's basically a teamwork. When an artist produces something, I mean, it's a teamwork where a lot of people participate. Now, this is the opening of the very first show that Castelli had. It was in Paris, Place Vendôme, which is a very good location, a very good address. But it opens on the 5th of July 1939, which is absolutely the worst possible date to open a show, right? Because a few days later, the Germans are in Paris. So, and you see René Drouin and Leo Castelli are happy to ask you to attend the inauguration of the Decorative Art Gallery, which would take place from 4 to 9 on Wednesday, the 5th of July, 1939. But it's Place Vendôme. Here is the location of the first Castelli Gallery, between the Ritz and between the Schiaparelli, the, you know, the designer Schiaparelli. This is one of the shots of this show with this gorgeous model under the Max Ernst piece called L'Ange du Foyer, where I think it's completely in a metaphor of what's happening. You know, this monster arriving on Europe, and this beautiful, you know, girl with bare arms, and this monster trying to. So it's really represents for me what's going to happen to Europe. So these are the conditions in which Castelli starts his career. He opens in the best possible location at the worst possible time. A few months later, in March 1941, he is in New York. He arrives in New York. And for basically 16 years, Castelli will live out of his wife's money. He has married a very rich woman. I'll tell you more about her later. So for 25 years, he lives out of his wife's money. And when he arrives in New York, 1941, it will take him 16 years before making a living, opening a gallery, and becoming Leo Castelli. But for 16 years, he's going through a metamorphosis. He is, you know, a banker. He worked in the insurance business. He had just opened a show in Paris. And the first thing which happens to him as a European is to arrive in New York and discover the Museum of Modern Art. He had heard about the Museum of Modern Art in Europe. And he's completely mesmerized by the permanent collection that Alfred Bach has gathered. And he told me, Leo told me, he said, when I arrived in New York in 1941, I thought that the permanent collection that Alfred Bach had done was an encyclopedia of European art that no European country could do at the time because Europe was at war. You know, and for European, it was very, very special. He said Bach had integrated the Russian futurists, the German expressionists, and the French surrealists. Of course, as you know, during World War I and World War II, Europe was at war, and the French didn't see Dutch German art. The Germans didn't see Russian art. You know, so it was basically bits and pieces. But what Castelli found was this extraordinary encyclopedia that Bach had gathered. And for 16 years, Castelli will visit the permanent collection of MoMA every single day. He had a job. He had a job that his father-in-law gave him. He was basically the boss. He was running a factory in New Jersey to make sweaters. He was in the schmatter's business. But he hated it. So at 9 o'clock, he would go to his office, and at 10, he was gone. He was at MoMA. So everybody was making fun of him. He was, you know, somebody who was very an amateur. He was a womanizer. He was an amateur collector. He was not a serious human being. He was well-read. He was reading books and looking at things. But he was not solid. He was not serious. You know, here we see the people he meets. You know, he meets Marcel Duchamp, Alfred Barr, and Sidney Janis, the gallerist, for whom Castelli is going to work a little bit. And this is, you know, this is him with his wife, Iliana, and, you know, friends. They have a lovely house on Upper East Side. They have a wonderful collection. They have a Mondrian. They have a Pollock, you know. And they, you know, nice people in town. But, you know, nothing serious. Here, Castelli works a little bit. You know, he's a collector, not a great collector, but a collector. Here he's sitting with Sidney Janis at the Venice Biennial. And here, And here is a show that he's doing at Sidney Janis Gallery. At the beginning, when he arrives, he wants to pair French artists and American artists to compare them. You know, because at the time, when he arrives in New York, he thinks, the art world in New York is extremely provincial. Artists are very provincial. Nobody knows them in Europe. They have a hard time with their dealers. The dealers don't work hard. And Castelli finds it, you know, very slow. So what he tries to do is to pair. He has, you know, here we have Motherwell and Soulage. He has Pollock and Lanskoy. He has, you know, different things. So he tries to pull the American painters by comparing them with the stars who are the French painters. Things are going to change very quickly. After that, they belong to a group of people from 1948 to 1955 called the Club. For the first time in America, artists mingled with intellectuals, writers, curators, musicians. For example, Hannah Arendt, the philosopher, belongs to the Club. She goes with John Cage. She meets with Pollock, with de Kooning, with the Castellis. And for the first time, you know, writers and intellectuals support the artist. This is a tradition that we have in Europe, but that didn't exist in the United States. In Europe, for example, Baudelaire wrote to support Delacroix. Zola wrote to support Cézanne. Or the Impressionists would meet with writers in cafes. In America, there are no cafes. In New York, there are not many cafes. You know, but here for the first time at this club, the artists and the collectors were mingling, and Ileana, the wife of Castelli, was very happy because they would meet three or four times a week. And here that's how they pay their dues. You see, Leo Castelli paid here, he paid here, and here you have, you know, the other names, you know, you have de Kooning, you have Pearl Fine, Bob Brischenburg, you know. And Ileana was very happy because she said, I would arrive in this, you know, very shabby place, and I would start sweeping the floor, cleaning, you know. It's the first time she ever swept the floor because she was. And after a while, in this group, the artists, and, you know, they meet in the club was near Washington Square, you know, in Cedar Bar and so on. And after a while, the artists, you know, that nobody's showing really. So they discover a place which is an old antique shop, which is basically a ruin. I need a water. And the artists say, we're going to show our art. And so they ask Leo Castelli to help them hang the show. This show takes place on 9th Street. It will be called the 9th Street Show. And it's basically artists showing themselves, but asking this guy who's a collector, Leo Castelli, to help them hang the show. So you see the name of the people, Al Copley, Cavallon, Motherwell, Nivola, Thibaut de Nage, Rauschenberg, Parsons. So the names which are added by hand are added by Leo Castelli. This is his handwriting. And this is the show. There was, so, you see the building, you know, when I think of your museum, Terry, you know, can you imagine here? You see, it's so ugly, you know, look, it's so ugly. Look at the, you know, and the Pollock here, it was so tight that the Pollock was hung upside down, no, on the side, you know. It was terrible, but, you know, they showed. And on that day, people came, that was downtown, that was below 14th Street. But on that day, a lot, and you know, those artists were living in cold, in studios, which had only cold water downtown. And, you know, they didn't have much money. But on that day, a lot of public came from Upper East Side. The rich people came, crossed the 14th Street border, right? And they arrived. And one of them called Castelli and said, can you tell me the name of those artists that I have never seen? You know, and that's the reason why Leo wrote down by hand. And that guy, the guy who asked him all the names, came from Upper East Side, was Alfred Barr. Alfred Barr, who was an American, but had never heard about those young American painters living in the same city. He had never crossed this 14th Street border. So when Castelli arrived in New York, it was Alfred Barr who taught him how to look at European art, his art, integrated in the collection of MoMA. But now, it is Castelli who's showing Alfred Barr how to look at the art of his country. So you have this very interesting interaction between Alfred Barr, the American, who's a specialist of European art, teaching that to the European Castelli. And you have the European Castelli who's teaching Alfred Barr, the American, about American art. This relationship will be a very interesting one, we'll see. These are some of the people he meets. You know, here to the left is Barnett Newman, the young Bob Rauschenberg, and Leo Castelli at the time, you know, where he mingles. At the time, you know, the Castellis were, you know, well-to-do people. They would give Christmas parties in their apartment at 4 East 77th Street. And for each of the artists invited, they had a present, which was a silk tie. And for the artist, it was incredible to get that as a present, or a drawing by Gorky, you know, for everybody, for all the women, you know. So they were really different, from a different social class than the artist. Or, for example, they had a house in East Hampton, the Castellis, and they would invite, you know, friends and artists here, for example. During two summers in a row, 52 and 53, they invited the de Koonings. And it was in the porch of the Castelli that the de Koonings had their studio. And the neighbors of the Castelli once, they saw de Kooning, you know, bicycle riding. And one of the rich neighbors said, "Can you tell your boss that the dog was barking last night?" And de Kooning said, "He's not my boss, you know." So some people thought he was a worker. You know, he was just, you know, the plumber. In a way, it's a time where, during the summer, de Kooning was able to overcome a block he had about his painting, and that's how he was able to start his series of women, you know, which is very interesting. So the Castellis were really interacting with the artist. And Leo at this time said, "The artists were my heroes. I would do anything for them." He came to the United States with the values of Europe, where he thought that artists were very important people. Leo Castelli adored creative people. He was in awe with writers and painters. And he decided to devote his life to them. So he helped de Kooning and Pollock to get better dealers, and he introduced them to Sidney Janis. And one day de Kooning asked Leo, he said, "Leo, one day you'll open a gallery, you'll have your own gallery, and you'll show me." But Leo's wife said, "No, Bill. Leo will not show you. He will have a gallery, that I am sure, but he will not show you, because he wants to discover new artists." Leo didn't want to show people who already existed. He wanted to find new things. He was looking for the new. So, you know, so they were having dinner with de Kooning, dinner with Pollock, and of course, the fights between the two of them. And one day, this was the first of Leo Castelli's epiphany, he went into the Jewish Museum, which was showing non-Jewish artists and contemporary people. And he saw that piece, which is Jasper Jones' Green Target. It's 57 actually. He came back home and he said to his wife, "I have seen something incredible. I have seen a piece which is square, which is made of a very, very unusual media. It was wax mingled with pigment. It was a very beautiful color. It was a theme that I had never heard about, a target. And the name of the artist was also so beautiful, Jasper Jones." So he was completely in awe with this piece. And a few days later, they go to another studio visit and to somebody called Bob Rauschenberg. So Bob Rauschenberg is very nice, very generous. He welcomes them. What do you want to drink? I want a Coke. Do you want ice in your Coke? Yes, I'm going to pick up the ice from my next-door neighbor, Jasper Johns. So Leo Cassidy, what did you say? Is he the guy who has the green target? Yes, yes. May I come with you? Of course you can. So he goes down and Leo says, I have seen a whole exhibition completely finished. I saw the targets, I saw the maps, I saw the numbers, I saw the letters. It was beautiful. So he went to Jasper and said, may I give you a show? Jasper says, yes. So Leo goes back and said to Rauschenberg, goodbye, I'm in a rush. So that was the first encounter with Jasper Johns. And a few months later, in February 1958, Jasper Johns' first show takes place at Leo Castelli's gallery, 4 East 77th Street, in his daughter's bedroom. And it's a complete masterstroke. I mean, the director of Art News, Tom Hess, shows a target on the cover of the magazine. Alfred Barr, the director of MoMA, comes for the opening and buys four paintings. And immediately, Jasper Johns, who's a 27-year-old artist who'd never had a show except this target, is launched to get the most extraordinary career. In a way, Leo Castelli launches Jasper Johns as a painter, but we can also say that Jasper Johns as a painter launches Leo Castelli as a gallerist. Well, a few months later, Rauschenberg steps into the gallery and says, what about me? Are you going to show me? But Leo is not there, just his wife is there. And she says, Bob, I promise Leo will show you very soon because you're older, so it's more complicated. And a few months later is the exhibition of Bob Rauschenberg's Combines. But it doesn't sell very well. It doesn't work as well as Jasper, which is easier to understand. But Rauschenberg's Combines are much more complicated and original in a way. And, breaking borders. So within four decades of his career, Castelli is going to show an amazing number of artists at an amazing pace. So here is the list of all the people he's going to show. Jasper Johns, Bob Rauschenberg, Frank Stella, Cy Twombly, Lee Bontecue, Roy Lichtenstein, John Chamberlain, Andy Warhol, Jim Rosenquist, Donald Judd, Christo, Bob Morris, Joseph Kosuth, Dan Flavin, Keith Saunier, Richard Serra, Richard Archwager, Ed Ruscha, Claes Oldenburg, Lawrence Weiner, Ellsworth Kelly, Kenneth Nolan, James Turrell, Julian Schnabel, David Sally, to name but a few. The question now is, what were the strategies of Castelli which were different from other gallerists? First of all, Castelli did something that nobody did before him. He integrated the scholars, the writers, as we do in Europe. And today I want to actually to dedicate my lecture to the memory of this man who just passed away, Leo Steinberg. He was an incredible character, a brilliant scholar, and he is the one, he was the Renaissance scholar. He was writing on Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci. And Leo Castelli immediately asked him to write about Jasper Johns. Leo Steinberg, the son of the Minister of Justice for Lenin, who spoke Russian and French and English and German brilliantly. And I interviewed him, and he was extraordinary.
So the strategy of Castelli was, if you ask the scholar of Michelangelo to write about Jasper Johns, this is a treat. You know? This is the way to go. This is the way to legitimize an unknown American artist, 27 years old. Same thing, he asked Bob Rosenblum to write about Frank Stella. And he asked also Frank O'Hara, the pianist and curator and poet, to write about this artist. Here he's with Larry Rivers. Also, when Castelli showed Andy Warhol, he asked Jean-Paul Sartre to write a piece in his magazine, Les Temps Modernes, to show that what Andy Warhol was doing was a social critic of the 60s in America. Furthermore, another strategy of Castelli was creating a
link with the Metropolitan and this also incredible character who was Henry Geldzahler, a link with the Whitney and Tom Armstrong, a link with the model again when arrived Kurt Vonnegut, who renewed the relationship. Also, Leo Castelli went his way, out of his way, to promote his artist. And here, it's Flag Day, the 14th of June, 1963. And for Flag Day, what does he do? He goes to give a flag to President Kennedy. The story is very funny, because I asked Jasper, but what was Leo doing here? And Jasper said, but when Leo called me, he said, Jasper, give me one of your flags. Jasper
Excuse
said,
me.
No, Leo, why?
It sounds like your mic went out. Do you mind if I switch your belt pack? I'm sorry to interrupt.
My mic is going out.
Yeah, we're not.
Yeah, it's okay. So Jasper said to Leo, I'm not giving one of my flag, give one of yours. So Leo took one flag from his collection. And then Jasper asked him, I asked Jasper, what did Leo expect from giving this flag to the president? And he said, I think he expected to have the president and the first lady to his openings, simply. So he was really trying extremely hard to promote his artist everywhere. But the best moment takes place right after this encounter with President Kennedy, when at the Venice Biennial 1964, Bob Rauschenberg gets the Golden Lion. It's the first time that an American artist gets this award. So Castelli manages to bring American artists to the center of the center, which gives the awards, which is the Venice Biennial. And never before had the American artist been accepted. Here, the works of the artist arrive by military plane to Venice. Here, they are transported by foot. Here, they're transported by gondola. And here, Bob Rauschenberg is getting the award. He's the curator for the show is Alan Salomon again, the friend of Leo. And here, in the crowd, you see next to Bob Rauschenberg and Alan Salomon, you see here Ileana. Ileana is the wife of Leo. They are now divorced. She remarries Michael Zonabend, and she lives in Paris. And what does she do in Paris? She represents the artist of her first husband with her second husband. Okay? And she is working she worked extremely hard to help Rauschenberg to get the prize. He is getting the prize. She has, you see her poster. She has poster all over Europe in all the magazines. This is a beautiful, and they're very, very, this is very new at the time, you see, to give posters of the. So here we see the way, 1 minute. Castelli, I need my bag, please. I need a handkerchief. He is, how Castelli is enjoying.
Zona Bengara in Paris. And here, just to show you the way Castelli operates, this is the little notebook that he has to organize the...
It went out again. I think there's something else going on. I think there's something with your belt pack. Would you like me to change
it? But I don't want to lose them. Okay. So here, you see that
the way Leo operates, he has this little notebook, very short, and here he writes, Robert Rauschenberg, Venice, interview, satellite, bar, biennial painting,
17 panels, Saint, Jasper Jones, Leo Steinberg, Salomon, thank you. And you see, so he really organizes his the whole program as a battle field, as a battle plan. Another very important moment takes place in 1974
when this guy, Robert Scull, in between his wife, Ethel, and Andy Warhol here, is selling his collection. He's been a big collector. And for many years, at Sotheby's Park Burnett, the auctioneers tried to sell American art. They tried 3, 4, 5 times with no results at all. But at last, in 1974, for this Scull sale, American art starts selling a little bit. So this is all the efforts of Castelli, and now that's the moment where American art is starting to get a market. Never before, 74. I'm sorry? Yeah, okay. So here, Castelli's also invented something, which was the geographical extension of his galleries. He was all over New York. You see here, first gallery here. Second gallery was a warehouse in Harlem when they needed to have big spaces to show, for example, the first Richard Serra. And then he had a print gallery, graphics, Castelli graphics, to get smaller pieces to people with less money, and photos and prints, so get another market. But then what happened is that Leo Castelli decided to move to Soho, and that's when he became the organic intellectual or gallerist of Soho. And he had 1, 2, 3, 4 galleries in Soho. So all in all, he had all these 9 galleries in New York City within 4 decades. And he really created in Soho the center of the contemporary art world. You can see here the bedroom of his daughter turned into a gallery with the first Jasper Jones show, and the beautiful staircase of his little, you know, private mansion, actually. Mm-hmm. This is the warehouse in Harlem. This is his second wife with the Castelli graphics. And this is the first wife in Soho. And for a few years, he would do the shuttle uptown, downtown, wife number two, wife number one, you know, getting some, you know, some interesting combinations with all of them. And everything worked fine. And here is with Jim Rosenquist in this new gallery. And his only partner, Larry Gagosian, with whom he had a gallery together. Not only did Leo have many galleries in New York, but many satellite galleries all over the country. And here in Dallas, Jenny Lee, who said she had a very hard time selling combines by Rauschenberg at the beginning. Mm-hmm. He had satellite galleries in St. Louis, in Kansas City, in Los Angeles, Vancouver, Minneapolis, Toronto, everywhere, Florida. He also had satellite galleries all over Europe, with his first wife doing, you know, the selling. And the two main collections were one in Cologne of Peter Ludwig and the other one in Varese of Giuseppe Panza di Biumo, the two most biggest collections of pop art in Europe. So Castelli, within 3 decades, became the first global gallerist with a network of satellite galleries that nobody else had done before him.
All in all, he didn't want to sell. He was not selling paintings. He was placing works of art in collections. We see him here with Jeffrey Deitch going to a private collection. Here with Bob Rauschenberg, he's going to the inauguration of Jimmy Carter at the White House. I think they look like two mafiosi Italian. Don't you think they look, you know, in their fur coats?
Yes.
Here with Cy Twombly in Venice, also very elegant. Here with Gianenzo Spironi to the left, one of his satellite galleries, and Joseph Cossus. Here with another satellite gallery, Tony Schifrazzi and Keith Haring. In fact, Castelli was working more or less like Joseph Duveen or Ambroise Vollard. He was in the wave of those great galleries. He said one day, Castelli said, "What is?" I'm going to tell you the right quotation. Castelli said one day, "What, you know?" He felt that there was a mission to be accomplished, said Castelli, and he said, I was playing an important role, the same role that patrons used to do in the time of the Renaissance. And he said, I had immense faith in what I was doing. And here he said, What is a little Cézanne? It's a house in the middle of a landscape. Why should it have value? Why is it worth $800,000? Because it's a myth. My job is to make a myth. So he was making myth about art, and he knew that he was the one who was getting out the prices. So he was basically working as I say in a certain chapter of the book, as an Austro-Hungarian diplomat. Castelli was born in Trieste in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and he was an extraordinary networker. What he was doing was organizing collections, and his strategies was that he had first of all legitimized the artist, but then his best tool, his best creation, was to invent the system that he called the waiting list. He would not sell a Jasper Johns for $1,000 to the first person who wanted to buy it. When he didn't want to sell, he said to the person, "I'll put you on the waiting list." So basically, he was the one who would tell you whether he would take your money or not. He made the paintings unavailable. Once he had made them precious and valuable and legitimized, he was a master of the game. With $1,000, you wouldn't buy a piece. He had to accept you. You had to pass a test. And a lot of people never passed the test. One of the people who never passed the test is still Leonard Loder. He told me, and Leonard Loder is the chairman of the board of the Whitney. He said, "Annie, I was always put on the waiting list, and I never left the waiting list." Cy Newhouse stayed on the waiting list for 3 years. In fact, Leo was the one who would give you the acceptance. You had to be accepted by him. Eli Broad, the collector and philanthropist from Los Angeles, says, "You had to earn your way with Leo. He would not sell to people who were not really involved. He would be polite. If he didn't want to sell, he would put you on the waiting list." And I can quote somebody called Doug Kramer, the big producer from California, for Santa Barbara. He recalls that he needed two introductions to Leo, a visit to the artist studio, and subsequently a lunch with the dealer and the artist before he could buy a Jasper Johns. I'm quoting him. "That was the closest thing to a papal appointment in those days." So here we see Castelli with Salvador Dali. We see him with the great, this is Panza di Biomo, the collector from Varese, here with Richard Serra. This is Panza di Biomo, that at the beginning he wrote to Leo, and Leo said, I can sell to you. He wrote a letter I'm quoting Leo, to Panza. There are certain things that you don't understand. Rauschenberg does not produce manufactured canvases. Rather, each of them is an invention. There are approximately 15 per year, and his work is well thought of. I don't have Rauschenbergs to sell you, he said to Panza, you know. So for many years, he didn't want to sell to Panza. And one day, Panza invited Leo to his country house in Italy. So Leo went, and that was a country house in Italy. So Leo decided, after seeing the country house, that he would sell to Panza. Leo said, I went to Panza's place. It's near Milan, on the lake, an old 17th century palace right in the middle of the park. It reminds you of last year in Marienbad. There was a living room just full of Roscoes and the dining room just full of Kleins. Really amazing. I mean, this is this castle with fantastic antique furniture in every room. You go up a solemn, very imposing staircase with all the ancestors' portraits. And then there are all this immense number of rooms and so on. So that's how Castelli accepted to take Panza as a collector and to sell to him. The Meyerhoffs also, the Eli Broad. This is Soho. This is really the very beginning of Soho, when people didn't know that, you know, it would become such. It was September 1971. So Leo is closing a deal. Leo is on the phone organizing, you know, really organizing everything. And the most important thing in the gallery, it's what happened when you got into the gallery. And there would be a big space, a big empty space with all the art. But afterwards, when you had seen the art, you would arrive at this space, which you can see here, and you see this was the famous velvet rope. As Castelli's artists were, as I told you, unavailable, here, Castelli himself was unavailable, because in the back you could see that there was his velvet rope, and he was in the back here in a little niche that you could see him, but you could not get to him. So I'm quoting Jeffrey Deitch. There were several stages to approach Castelli, and I cannot help thinking in terms of his inner circle. There were several stages, and you really had to earn your way. In the first stage, you went up to the velvet rope, but nobody opened it for you. You were not allowed in. In the second stage, one of the Brundage sisters, the Garris, would open the velvet rope and invite you in. In the final stage, you had the access. You could just lift up the velvet rope yourself and walk in. So this is the way that Castelli installed, you know, rules in his world. This is him with his staff. People adored him. They felt like they were part of a family. There was a very democratic relationship in the gallery. Here, surrounded by his artists, the same thing. And all the artists had a very warm bond with him. They said, you know, we felt like a family. They said he was like a father figure to us. And, you know, you see that Leo here, you know, as a center of a group. And here is Leo at the age of 20 in Trieste, center of a group. These are all the moves from his life. He was born in Trieste. He went first to live in Vienna during World War I, back to Trieste, went to his grandmother in Hungary, back to Trieste. to Milan to study, back to Trieste, went to Bucharest, where he met his wife, Ileana, then to Paris, where he opened the gallery, and then they went to the United States. The story that I want to end on is a beautiful story. It's at the end of his life, Leo decided to donate one of his works of his permanent collection, private collection, to the Museum of Modern Art. And this piece he owned is that piece, Bed, one of the combines by Bob Rauschenberg. This photo is taken in his in Bob's studio in 1955, when at the time Bob said, nobody was looking at my art. I was doing work for Jasper, and Jasper was doing work for me. Nobody was interested. Anyway, eventually Leo bought this bed, and he had it in his home. He gave it to MoMA in 1989, at a time where bed was estimated $11 million. He had bought it for $1,100. Leo Castelli could have sold it and made money out of it, but Leo was not about money. Leo was about education. So he donated to MoMA in honor of Alfred Barr. Here is the party where he donates a work with Agnes Gunt and Bob Rauschenberg. Mm-hmm. Here is the piece itself. Here it is in the galleries of MoMA. And here is the label. Gift of Leo Castelli in honor of Alfred Barr Jr., 1989. Why is this gesture so important for me? Because, as I told you before, Castelli arrived in New York and he discovered the collection that Alfred Barr had made. For him, Alfred Barr was his mentor. He learned European art, his art, through Alfred Barr. He got his education through Alfred Barr. So why did he donate this piece in honor of Alfred Barr? Because he felt that he needed to change the narrative of American art to educate the American public in the galleries of MoMA, but also because I think that it was a gesture of an American. Leo Castelli, thanks to Alfred Barr, had become an American. He promoted American art, and it is an American tradition to pay a tribute to your alma mater and to donate to your alma mater. So he donated bed to his alma mater, the modern, in honor of Alfred Barr, his mentor, a very American gesture. He, who was the emigrated Jew from Europe, who never wanted to say that he was Jewish, who never denied he was Jewish, but who never volunteered to say he was Jewish, he had found at the modern and in the United States another identity promoting American artists. I think we should end with that, and I would love to answer your questions. Thank you very much. Yes.
How many other pieces has he donated to the museum?
I think not that many. I think that's the one I know about. Wait.
I'm wondering, can you comment on how do you compare him to the Wildensteins as a dealer? And were they friends? And
yes.
What is that relationship like?
Actually, Guy Wildenstein wanted to buy the Castelli Gallery at the end. He even told me, and he wrote a letter to Leo, and he sent me the letter. The letter is in the book. The Wildensteins are this Jewish family from Europe who showed the Impressionists. And actually, it's the Wildenstein Gallery now today who's doing the catalog resin of Jasper Johns. Funnily enough, they knew each other very well. Castelli didn't collect Impressionist paintings, and at the time the Wildenstein didn't show contemporary art. They did show contemporary art only recently when they got Pace Gallery with Arnie Glimcher, and now they got separated recently again. So they knew each other. They didn't do business together, but, and Wildenstein had wanted to get hold of the Castelli Gallery. And at the end, Wildenstein said, well, there's only one Castelli, nobody can buy Castelli. So basically the gallery disappeared. So they had a great respect for each other. But you know, the way Castelli operated is very different from any other gallery. Because Castelli, I think, completely transformed the culture of the United States. Castelli arrived in a country where people had not much respect for the artists, the United States. I wrote a whole book about that. Many, many reasons. What Castelli did was he, for the first time, made Americans realize that an artist is precious. He made the artist become the king. He forced the collectors to fight to get the art. He transformed the relationship between social classes, between the, you know, the capitalist who is the collector and the artist who is a nobody. He, by creating this waiting list, he was the one who allowed the collector to get. So he completely, he revolutionized the status of the artist. Castelli worked in the United States as, and that's what I discovered when I went inquiring about his past. He had told me one day that I should go to a village in Tuscany called Monte San Savino. He said, you should see, because that's where my mother's family came from. So I went to see this village, and I discovered that the Castellis arrived in this village in the 15th century, and that already for three centuries, the Castellis were selling alcohol, tobacco, but especially paper to the artists. So most probably, the ancestors of Leo Castelli sold paper to Piero della Francesca and Vasari in this village. So basically what I discovered in the Castelli ancestors were working like agents at the time of the Medici. And what I decided is that Leo Castelli worked as an agent of the Medici in New York of the 60s and the 70s. He completely transported those methods, networking, traveling, knowledge of languages. So he's, and he created for the American artist a genealogy that didn't exist before by asking Leo Steinberg to write about Rauschenberg. He did the same thing as Vasari did in Vita dei Artisti, when Vasari said, Bronzino is a student of Allori, and you know, he created links between Leonardo, you know, so Castelli created links between the artists. Castelli told the history, inserted American artists in the history of art. He said that Jasper was like Ingres, and Rauschenberg was like Delacroix. You know, he really compared them with a big stream of art history. That's transforming radically the way art was perceived in America by creating the networks of galleries all over the country, all over the world, you see. And one thing which is a sign of that is that in November 2008, I went to the Modern for to the Metropolitan for the funeral service of Bob Rauschenberg. It was November 08, just before Obama was elected. And it was a Monday evening. It was beautiful. It was huge. It was full of people. And people paid a tribute to Rauschenberg. And we had a list of the people talking. Even his nurse was singing a song, and his son was talking. But then somebody arrived that was not on the program. And the master of ceremonies said, we're going to welcome somebody. It's a surprise for everybody. And suddenly appeared a man with a purple tie. It was Bill Clinton. It's the first time that I ever saw a politician pay a tribute to an artist in this country. When I was at the embassy, the president never came to the museums. It's not the tradition in Europe. We have presidents who are writers, you know. But I was surprised to see that usually politicians are not interested in culture and art, you know. At the time I was there, you know. But when the fact that Bill Clinton spoke about Rauschenberg and said he was the best of us. He said Jackie Kennedy created the Rose Garden. Hillary turned it into a sculpture garden. And we're so proud to have a sculpture by Rauschenberg. You know, I thought that was the hand of Castelli in the United States, you know. He made it possible for Bill Clinton to appear and pay a tribute to Bob Rauschenberg. You see what I mean? Did I answer your question a little bit too much? Okay, yes?
From the time he would discover one of these artists, during this incubation period,
yes,
when he was doing
the
PR and marketing,
yes,
how would he feed them and how would he prevent them from selling direct to clients and circumventing this long process of marketing them?
I'm not sure I understand what you said.
So, these artists were probably starving, right? Right.
Yes.
So how does he keep them loyal to his gallery and prevent them from selling directly to clients?
Okay, listen. When he arrives, it's a time of the abstract expressionists, who are a big bunch of big guys. It's impossible to step in. So much so that Rauschenberg has to go to de Kooning, buy a drawing and erase the drawing in front of him. You know the story, right? So it's very hard for younger artists to break into the big group of the abstract expressionists. And that's what Castelli will allow. You know, he will allow these younger artists to step in. But are you asking me how he prevents his artists to sell directly to collectors?
Well, and would he commission them or support them financially along the way?
Yeah. Maybe I forgot to say that. But I'm sorry. Thank you so much for helping me. One of the things that Castelli instituted is, for the first time, he decided to give monthly payment to his artists, whatever they would do. So, yeah, sorry. That's the first thing I should have said. That's a big difference with any other galleries before. He told me, he said, I was giving monthly stipends to my artists the same way Gaston Gallimard was doing for Sartre and Camus. He really took the model of the European, publishers, you know. It was a great tradition. You know, in Europe we have this passion for creators, you know. So he would pay them. And the one who was the most expensive was Dan Flavin, you know. Because, you know, or because of the materials, you know. But whatever, even if the artist didn't produce much, he would give out the money. So that was the key. Yes, thank you for reminding me. Yes, sir.
I think I saw Bed in several exhibits over the years in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And it was widely loaned out to museums for exhibition. I don't know if it belonged to Castelli during that period. But it raises a question. Would Castelli loan a lot of his own personal collections for these kind of exhibits? Was he generous in that regard?
Oh, yes. But, you know, Bed, if I may say, sometimes before the 70s was on loan to many shows, and most of the time it went there, but they didn't show it. It happened in Spoleto, it happened in Documenta in Castle, because people were shocked by this piece. They thought it was the scene of a murder, of a crime, of a rape, you know. It put people with a very odd feeling. Many stories about Bed which they didn't like, you see. But eventually, now people like this piece. Castelli he was not a collector. His wife, Ileana, was a great collector. So much so that when she passed away 3 years ago, people evaluated her collection, and the tax succession they had to pay was $500 million. You can imagine the collection she had. Castelli, on the other side, didn't collect much. In his home, he had 2 Jasper Johns, 1 Liechtenstein, 1 Stella, 1 Rauschenberg, you know, a few pieces. A Tiffany light, an Amish table, lots of books, very simple. And one day, the director of the Stedelijk Museum came to see Leo at his home and said, this Liechtenstein is fantastic. How much is it? Leo said, it's not for sale. But how much would it? Anyway, all in all, he managed to buy it from Leo. He bought it for the Steli. You know, but Castelli was not there for the money. He was there for education. He was on a mission. He felt that he had to educate the public. He was doing, you know, an educational. His gallery was like a school, a university. He had extraordinary archives that all the you know, professors and critics would go and look for. For example, Rosalind Krauss, professor at Columbia, she said, I was a young PhD student at Harvard and I would go to Castelli every month because I knew that he had the best possible shows. You know, so it was a way, it was a place where people went, where people learned. So he educated the American audience and he changed the relationship between artist and public. Yes, sir?
So, Gary, what you said, it was your lecture just now, and he had a 17-year period, I understand, in which he came to New York and seemed to browse around and yep. this and that and next thing, but he was reading continuously, he was educating himself continuously.
Yep.
He was very involved.
Yes.
And then when he finally sprang himself on the American public, it was his demands
yes.
that they would have to meet his needs.
Exactly.
And it was a totally different personality. They have never met that kind of person before.
That's exactly it.
And it just, as you mentioned, it just changed the whole context.
You say it much better than me. It's a new book. That's, thank you so much. That's exactly it. And he became the best, you know, this man who, until the age of 50, had never earned his living, became the best. And I think that comes from the tradition of the family.
Yes.
You know, although he never wanted to say he was Jewish, he was, you know, he had experienced, and his family had experience. You know, the exile, the reconstruction, the, you know, it was a terrible life. In fact, he never said anything about the past. What I discovered is that his father had become a banker and was even a fascist banker, although he was Jewish. And then the father lived in Budapest during the war. The father and the mother at the age of 75 had to hide in a closet for during the siege of Budapest. And they had to cross the Danube swimming. And then the mother drowned in the Danube and the father was put in a common grave. You know, I mean, nobody knew about that. Castelli decided to put this veil, this famous veil I told you. So that's what I discovered by digging. I discovered that his life, his past was much more interesting, complex, tragic than the stupid stories he was telling. But that was his right. You know, you built your life the way you want. You tell, you create your own myth the way you want, the way you need. It's your need. I don't judge. We shouldn't judge, you know. So he created these stupid stories to hide the tragic history that his family had behind and to reinvent himself as this, you know, cheerful American. You know? So that's the story of Leo Castelli.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you.